Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi there, and welcome to the Explaining History podcast. And in this podcast today, I want to talk about the relationship between the United States and nationalist China at the end of the Second World War and at the commencement or the recommencement of the Chinese Civil War, which would end in 1949 with a communist victory under Mao Zedong. In early 1946, George Marshall, the former chief of the US General Staff and America's top soldier, came to China after his exceptional talent in military organization and marrying together military necessities and political realities during the Second World War. He believed that it was possible for him to help the US to help broker a truce in China in the resurgent civil war that had broken out from 1945 onwards between the communists and the nationalists. By 1946, this war would have been ongoing for 20 years on and off. And it was viewed in Washington as being almost the unfinished business of the Second World War in Asia. And despite the strong links that the Americans had with the nationalists in China and the fighting that American and nationalist forces had done together in China, in Burma, and in other parts of the China-Burma-India theatre, there seemed to be an immense amount of naivety in Washington about the inner workings of both communist and nationalist politics. On the 4th of March, the general flew to Yan'an to meet Mao at the communist headquarters there in the far northeast of China. Marshall himself was a profound anti-communist. He was far more from the Truman camp of confronting communist expansion than from the Roosevelt way of thinking about these sorts of things. But as Americans and British attachés and generals had been impressed by the stoicism and discipline of Stalin and Stalin's troops, so when Marshall met Mao again, he thought that he was a man of real substance, and he was impressed about the tenacity of the Chinese communist troops. The reality, of course, was that it had been the nationalists that had borne much of the brunt of fighting against the Japanese from 1937 onwards, not the communists. The trip that Marshall takes to China in 1946 in many ways seals the fate of Chiang Kai-shek, because Marshall becomes convinced that there is no future for the nationalists in China, just as when Marshall was to visit Europe and subsequently give his famous address to Harvard University on the 5th of June 1947, in which he essentially revealed what he saw as being Europe's future. So too, his views on China were equally influential a year earlier. Having had what he believed to be some plain talking from Mao, Marshall met Chang and found him to be a very superficial character, a rather pompous figure who liked to be referred to as Generalissimo, who enjoyed uniforms and had become quite a corrupt figure as his administration had worn on from the late 1920s onwards. This was not the Chang of his youth, a powerful figure who had taken on China's warlords, who, along with ministers like T.V. Sung, had brought about a great deal of modernisation, financial and economic modernisation in China. This was an entirely more decadent character, one who had come to really enjoy the trappings of power, and one for whom Marshall had very little time. There seemed to me to be some very interesting parallels between Chang and the US government in 1946 and the Diem government in Vietnam in the late 1960s, or the early 1960s, I beg your pardon. In the first case, it was abundantly clear to Marshall that this corrupt government of generals and landlords had very little to offer the peasants and very little popular support. In the latter case, when a similar junta junta was in charge in Vietnam, there seemed to be very little understanding that there would ultimately be no popular appeal for this government, no matter what its anti-communist credentials might be. America became increasingly reluctant to help Chang, and the flow of arms, whilst it continued, was given ever more begrudgingly. Certainly this was far from how things had been a few years beforehand, when as much material assistance as was possible was offered on a lend-lease basis during the Second World War and the struggle against Japan. The economic failings of China, the chaos that the country was in, and once again, the question of corruption had marred Chang's regime, and certainly Washington was unwilling to allow American dollars to fill Chinese generals' pockets. Both Mao and Chang, though it's difficult to judge with what degree of sincerity on either side, said that they would accept a ceasefire when Marshall met the pair of them. The story of the next 3 years is a very instructive one. By the end of the Second World War, the Nationalists held most of the country. Under them were nearly 500 million Chinese. They controlled most of the fertile farmland. They controlled nearly all the big cities. And the Communists, whilst they controlled the north and the east, which was a territory which contained about 150 million people, still didn't seem by 1945 to be a credible threat to the power of the Nationalists. The Nationalists had come close to wiping the Communists out in the late 1930s, but within 3 years this situation had been reversed, in part to do with America's withdrawal and Stalin's support for Mao, which comes rather belatedly, but it's also to do with something else. It's to do with the fact that when the majority of Chinese people decided that the Nationalists had very little to offer them, this is when you suddenly see large transitions occurring, and the failure of the Nationalist regime to do any kind of meaningful work in the changing of life conditions for the majority of Chinese people. It's not to say there weren't modernizations, there certainly were, but endemic corruption and the concentration of power and wealth in a small number of hands does nothing to endear the regime to the people. Mao, in the early 70s, when he finally accepted a visit from a now repentant Japan, told the Japanese Prime Minister at the time that he couldn't have thanked Japan more for all the help they did in they gave in helping the communists to power. He said, you know, without the anarchy that you wrought in China, we would never have been able to unseat the nationalists, so thanks very much. One of the problems that China's Civil War presented to America was that the very loose kind of embryonic vision that Roosevelt had for a post-war order, which never really reached its full expression because he was ill and he died, of a kind of a multipolar world, was incapable of being realised. Roosevelt thought that the Americans, the British, the Russians and the Chinese, as four great powers, would be able to establish spheres of influence, of which China's would be Southeast Asia, and each of these powers would agree to respect the interests of the other. In doing so, the Chinese would become part of the means by which the world was regulated. A multipolar world is in a lot less volatile in many ways than a bipolar world, as any power acting out of line immediately has three others that will gang up on it and say, back down. And that means that spheres of influence, wherever they are, will be protected, and that there won't be any transgression of those spheres of influence, or it will be highly unlikely, and therefore you're unlikely to get wars. More particularly, you're unlikely to get a global war like the one you just had. So the Chinese Civil War, when China couldn't be a participant in this new theorised system, and it also meant that the British are also out of the picture, as they are bankrupt. And so instead of getting a multipolar world, you get a Cold War bipolar world emerging, which is highly volatile. But for ordinary Chinese people, life within China was extremely difficult. Not only had over 12 million people been killed during the Second World War, after the devastation of the Soviet Union, the Japanese pillaging of China is the greatest, shows that accounts for the greatest death toll of the war. But in 1946 to 47, the cost of living starts to dramatically escalate. The cost of living in Shanghai, for example, that year was 900 times its pre-war level. So poverty and hyperinflation obviously go hand in hand at this point. China had had an immense value to the USA during the Second World War, and it had been a place in which many of Japan's most significant offensives, like the Ichigo Offensive, had been fought, and it also had become a site for air bases by which to bomb the Japanese home islands before the Pacific Islands were seized, and it also drew large numbers of Japanese soldiers away from America's war in the Pacific. It was widely understood on both sides in China, the communists and the nationalists, that fighting would resume as soon as the Japanese had been defeated. And the starting pistol, really, for the Chinese resumption of the Chinese Civil War is the dropping of the atomic bomb on Hiroshima. The American military mission to China had been led by Vinegar Joe Stilwell, called Vinegar because of his acidic wit, a talented military man, but one who was under no illusions about Chang and was also highly critical of China.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Itself. In Victor Sebastian's 1946, he quotes an interview with Time magazine where Stilwell says, "The trouble in China is simple. We're allied to an ignorant, illiterate, superstitious peasant son of a bitch," by which he meant Chiang Kai-shek. He added in an official communique to the War Department, "Anything that's done in China will be done in spite of, not because of, Chiang and his military clique. The army is generally in a desperate condition, underfed, underpaid, undertrained, neglected and rotten with corruption. We can pull them out of this cesspool, but continued concessions have been made the Generalissimo believe that he has only to insist and we will yield." He later said to Washington, "The Chinese government is a structure based on fear and favour in the hands of an ignorant, arbitrary and stubborn man." So he had little good to say about Chiang Kai-shek. When Stilwell paid his first visit to China and began to draw his unflattering conclusions about Chiang, he also learned that $500 million had essentially vanished. This was money that had been given in grants and loans to the nationalist government and had disappeared into the bank accounts of, among others, T.V. Sung, who had been the principal operative in negotiating the loans in the first place. These loans were devised in such a way as to benefit Sung as much as possible and to be basically as little use to China and its war effort. And the personal fortune that Sung amassed was really largely based on embezzlement. One of the natural constituencies of the nationalists should have been the urban middle class of China, the merchants, the white-collar workers, and the people who stood most to lose from the communists. But it was this kind of embezzlement and corruption and graft that naturally alienated that constituency. And another key constituency that would have been very helpful to have on board was Middle America itself. The flow of newspaper stories, most of them accurate and balanced, into American newspapers about the corruption of Chiang Kai-shek left American taxpayers tired of high taxes from wartime and wartime obligations to other countries, feeling resentful that American money was going to line the pockets of Chinese dictators. Chiang Kai-shek was not unaware of the level of graft and wrote in his diary that close aides were indulging in extreme extravagance, whoring wildly and gambling with no restraint. They brag, swagger, extort and stop at nothing. But he did nothing to prevent any of this. Chiang Kai-shek, apocryphally, when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, put on one of his favourite records, Aida, and danced around the room in nothing less than unbridled joy that now he would have America on his side in the struggle against Japan. And he had perhaps become too accustomed to seeing America as his sole source of survival and his sole source of finance. Perhaps the one thing that did go in Chiang Kai-shek's favour with the American government, if not the American public, was the fact that the nationalists had put in significant efforts into fighting the Japanese. Mao, as I previously mentioned, had done basically nothing and had hoped that the Japanese and the nationalists would destroy one another, and then he would be able, with the communist forces he had amassed, to sweep into central China at the end of the war and pick up the pieces. Communist myth-making after 1949 had it that Mao was at the front of anti-Japanese resistance, and there are even now revisionist films that show Mao miraculously appearing at wartime conferences, which obviously is utterly ludicrous. Chiang Kai-shek appeared at the Cairo conference, but that was the limit of it. Certainly Mao didn't leave China during the war. And one of the key reasons why it was important not to engage the Japanese is because they were significantly better at fighting than Chinese communists, and Lin Biao, the Red Army commander who later went on to be one of Mao's favourites, dying in the Cultural Revolution, later said that it was better that the Chinese keep their powder dry and avoid direct conflict with the much more skilled and better equipped Japanese. One way that Mao did spend his time during the war was refining in Yan'an many of the basic principles of Maoist governance that he would employ after 1949. His Maoist terror was piloted in Yan'an. There was the embryo of collectivization and self-criticism. Party that, as far as Mao was concerned, periodically became too complacent, too arrogant, and needed to be brought back into line. But party officials and soldiers were forced into the kind of the torment of self-criticism that would be used during events such as the Cultural Revolution and the Hundred Flowers Campaign. And an interesting phenomenon happens once again when prior to Marshall meeting Mao, when other American officers during the war, diplomats during the war, met him when Chiang would allow them through in small parties into Yan'an territory, is that as Stalin had done a reasonably good charm offensive on Roosevelt and led Roosevelt to believe that the Soviet state would eventually settle down into something far more liberal and far more pluralistic, that really Mao was a very, very kind of moderate figure who wanted to simply raise the living standards of China's peasants, which no doubt he ostensibly did do, but there was very little understanding of the bloodthirsty methods that he would use in order to do this. And there was a view that was reported back to Washington that Mao was essentially a fairly democratic figure, a mild agrarian socialist, something far more liberal than even many of the socialist partisan groups in places like the Balkans that were allies of convenience to United States and Great Britain. So these sorts of ideas about Mao, however misleading, filtered back to Washington and influenced thought at Washington, particularly when it came to questions as to whether to continue supporting Chiang Kai-shek. Obviously, the American administration under Truman doesn't want Chiang Kai-shek to fall and doesn't want a communist government in China, but the logic is, well, do we want to continue pouring American money into these corrupt pockets, and if we do, will it be any the better for China? And if we walk away, will China fall to a Chinese Stalin, or will this Mao figure be, you know, of the left, but not quite as bad as we feared? And it enables perhaps American diplomats and decision makers to convince themselves that there is little invested in the continued support of Chiang Kai-shek. The Americans were, of course, unaware at this point that Mao was financing much of the communist cause through opium. The Soviets were well aware of this and reminded him from Moscow that drug dealing and socialism rarely went hand in hand. Mao thought that there was such a great deal of potential in dealing opium throughout Asia that it would be folly to give this up in the name of ideology. And indeed, the million or so half kilogram parcels of opium that were distributed throughout Asia each year during the 1940s gives you a clue as to how much revenue was raised. And within the dynamic between Moscow and Mao would be the seeds of later hostility to come. Mao worships Stalin, admires him. If you read Frank Dakota's books, there's abundant evidence there that Mao looked upon Stalin as a tutor. There is, if you look in the Marxist Internet Archive, look at Mao's letters about Stalin, there's many a writing to Stalin or about Stalin that is gushing in his praise. He gets to meet Stalin for the first time in 1949 and is kept waiting for a significant period of time over the winter 49 to 50. And when it is kind of Stalin's birthday celebrations. And he believed that having brought a kind of a quarter of humanity under the communist banner, he would be welcomed with open arms by Stalin. Stalin doesn't see it like that. Stalin sees Mao not only as a kind of a heretical figure who doesn't conform to the basic principles of Stalinism and sees a different approach to communism emerge, but also the potential of an existential threat to his leadership of the communist world. That's a kind of a slightly bigger topic area, on one which I think we have pursued in the past, the Mao-Stalin relationship, and we'll talk again about in the future. But the next podcast we're going to do on this is going to look at what happens when it's decided in America that the support for the Chinese nationalists can go no further. And later in 1946, that's precisely what happens when George Marshall decides that really there is no further scope for helping Chiang Kai-shek. Okay, well, I hope you find that useful. Apologies, by the way, for the delay in podcasts recently. Essentially, life and other things, work and the unfortunate inevitabilities of modern existence intrude periodically. But thanks very much for everyone's continued support. If you want to say hi, drop by our Facebook page, Explaining History on Facebook, and or if you can, go and give us a good thumbs up at iTunes. Every review does a heck of a lot of good for us, so please give that a shot. Anyway, I shall speak to you all soon. All the best. Bye-bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.